Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching and Life. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse, und in der heutigen Folge spreche ich mit einem unglaublich inspirierenden Mann. Lama Rod Owens hat eine sehr einzigartige Lebensgeschichte, die er mit uns teilt. Wir sprechen über Wut, über Liebe, über Zurückgezogenheit, über Aktivismus und über ein grenzenlos offenes Herz. Viel Freude damit. Ich freue mich wahnsinnig, dass ihr hier seid, und ich freue mich wahnsinnig über meinen heutigen Gesprächspartner, Lama Rod Owens. Ich verfolge das, was Lama Rod Owens macht, schon seit einiger Zeit, und seine Message ist zurzeit aktueller und brisanter denn je. Lama Rod hat eine sehr einzigartige Lebensgeschichte. Er ist schwarzer Amerikaner, geboren und aufgewachsen in den Südstaaten in einem sehr christlich-konservativen Haushalt. Schon als junger Mann fand er sich durch seine Hautfarbe und durch seine Homosexualität oft in einer Umgebung wieder, die ihm feindlich gesinnt war. Und wenn sie ihm nicht feindlich gesinnt war, dann hat sie ihn zumindest extrem in seiner Identität herausgefordert und oft weder akzeptiert noch gestützt. Sehr früh hat Lama Rod dadurch erkennen müssen, dass die Systeme, in denen er sich befindet, mehr als marode sind und unbedingt umgewälzt werden müssen. Er hat sein Zuhause verlassen und ist aktivistisch sehr tätig geworden. Durch seine aktivistischen Tätigkeiten und das Umfeld, in das er dadurch gekommen ist, hat er Meditation entdeckt. Und für ihn war das am Anfang was ganz, ganz Unangenehmes, aber er wusste, dass er irgendwie da drin was entdecken kann. Und dann hat er einen ziemlich radikalen Schritt gemacht. Er ist nämlich sehr schnell und sehr bald nach seiner ersten Meditationssession in ein traditionelles tibetisches 3-Jahres-Retreat gegangen. In diesen Retreats ziehen sich die Meditierenden 3 Jahre, 3 Monate, 3 Wochen und 3 Tage zurück, um intensiv ihren eigenen Geist zu erforschen. Leute, die aus diesem Retreat herauskommen, dürfen sich Lama nennen. Das ist also ein Titel im tibetischen Buddhismus, den man sich durch so ein Retreat quasi erarbeitet. Seit Lama Rod aus dem Retreat heraus ist, hat er 2 Bücher verfasst. Das erste heißt Radical Dharma zusammen mit 2 anderen Autorinnen und beschäftigt sich mit den Themen von Schwarzsein, Queersein und Aktivistischsein und verschiedenen anderen Dingen im Kontext von Buddhismus, in dem Kontext von einem modernen amerikanischen Buddhismus und davon, was es heißt, Meditation und Buddhismus in ein aktives, bewusstes Leben zu integrieren. Sein 2. Buch ist gerade erschienen. Es heißt Love and Rage, also Liebe und Wut oder Liebe und Rage. Und wir sprechen über diese Gefühle und darüber, wie diese Gefühle sowohl ein Katalysator und ein Motor sein können, als auch Gefühle, die wir miteinander vereinen müssen, um wahrlich wirksam in der Welt zu sein. Lama Rod ist unglaublich offen mit seinem eigenen Leben, mit seinem eigenen Werdegang, seinen eigenen Gedanken und auch seinen eigenen Problemen und Issues. Er fordert Leute dazu auf, in seinen Vorträgen ihn gerne zu unterbrechen, wenn er was sagt, was nicht stimmt, was nicht vernünftig ist oder was die Leute irgendwie verletzt. Er fordert seine Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer, seine Gesprächspartner aktiv dazu auf, mit ihm in den Dialog zu gehen und ihn sogar out zu callen. Denn da, sagt Lama Rod, beginnt die wirkliche Arbeit mit starken Emotionen, starken Gefühlen und vor allem auch damit, scheinbare Gegensätze wie Liebe und Abneigung gleichzeitig im Herz zu halten und sich klar zu entscheiden, und zwar dafür, beides zu fühlen. Im Kontext der aktuellen politischen und sozialen Situation in den USA, im Kontext von Black Lives Matter, im Kontext von Corona, im Kontext von Donald Trump und all diesen Dingen, ist Lama Rod zurzeit sehr, sehr viel unterwegs, weil er mit seiner Geschichte und seinen Themen und seiner Art, damit umzugehen, einfach absolut am Puls der Zeit ist. Wir haben in diesem Gespräch nicht so sehr über Corona oder über Black Lives Matter und über diese Dinge gesprochen. Vor allem wollte ich sie nicht unbedingt ihm aufzwingen, da er ganz viele Interviews dazu gegeben hat, da er ganz viele Talks, Vorträge, Diskussionen dazu geführt hat. Wenn ihr euch also spezifisch für seine Aussagen zu diesen Themen interessiert, so findet ihr alle weiterführenden Links natürlich in den Shownotes zu dieser heutigen Folge. Ebenso in den Shownotes findet ihr das elektronisch erstellte Transkript dieser Folge. Also wenn ihr einige Sachen auf Englisch vielleicht verpasst oder nicht ganz versteht, könnt ihr die nochmal nachlesen, so gut wie der Computer das hinkriegt. Und auf YouTube könnt ihr euch diese Folge natürlich auch nochmal anhören und die deutschen Untertitel dazu einschalten. Für mich war das Gespräch mit Lama Rod sehr berührend, sehr persönlich berührend, sehr tiefgreifend und sehr inspirierend. Ich habe gelacht, in mir drin hat sich sehr viel bewegt und an einer Stelle war ich sogar zu Tränen gerührt. Ich hoffe, ihr habt ähnlich viel Inspiration, Freude, Spaß und berührende Momente mit diesem Gespräch mit Lama Rod Owens.
So Lama Rod, thank you very much and very much welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time. Congratulations on the book that you just released. It's not out in German yet, but some people will have a chance to read it in English. And I would love to start this with sort of picking up a thread that you opened up in the beginning of your new book called Love and Rage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things I'd love to unpack. I think it's going to be impossible in the time, but mm-hmm. we start somewhere. And this one is, you start with an experience.
Yeah.
You describe how you're giving a talk and mm-hmm. A young man raises mm-hmm. his hand and talks about meditation and anger. And the experience is, so when I meditate, I don't encounter the bliss and the happiness first, but what I meet is my anger. And then he goes on to say, like, I don't know if I need that. I think I need a little bit more happiness. What's going on here, right? Mm-hmm. So you say something beautiful. I'm just quoting sort of from memory. You have to wrestle with the anger in order to get to the heartbreak. Because if you don't get to the heartbreak, you don't get to the healing.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, as you're leaving this gathering, you're thinking there is something else. Mm-hmm. There is something I wish I could have communicated or something I myself have to delve into more. Could you take me on that journey? Where did this journey lead you to? This looking.
Yeah. You know, during that time, you know, questions around anger were quite common. You know, and I kept getting them over and over and over again. And I felt like I never had an adequate response for folks, you know. And so at that event, when, you know, this young Black man asked me that, you know, and I felt like I gave a pretty good response, you know, and I actually have a video from the event. So I went back and watched it, you know, and transcribed it, actually. So I'm not making that up. Went back. And listen to everything. And I remember walking out of that event, and my publisher happened to be at that event. Mm-hmm. And my publisher was actually the one who reminded me about that event to go back and look at. And I remember we all walked out together, and I just kind of looked at him. I was like, I think I just need to do this. I think I need mm-hmm. to write a book about anger. And I had no idea how that was going to happen because I, you know, it's weird because I've done so much work around anger, and now it's natural mm-hmm. for me to do this, you know? And so my journey after that moment of committing to writing this book really began, it really was about going back and paying attention to all the ways that I had developed methods and strategies mm-hmm. to work with my anger, mm-hmm. you know? And that was a journey in itself, because I had to go back and unpack mm-hmm. all these things and articulate things that I'd never articulated before, you know, about anger and heartbreak and suffering and using the energy of anger, you know, to benefit folks. I mean, that was, this was all a new journey for me, mm-hmm. you know, to articulate that, mm-hmm. you know, for folks. And so it was creating a different kind of book. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, I think people initially thought it would be a self-help book mm-hmm. where it would be really nicely organized and like points that you could like really, you know, kind of bring into a practice and really get like this instant kind of benefit. Mm-hmm. And it's really not that kind of book. It's a book where it, I feel as if it's a book that invites you to step in to a really intense inner process of looking and experiencing these different aspects of who and what you are, you know. And it's not so much about anger as it is about woundedness. You know, we can talk all day about anger, but no one wants to talk about the hurt. You know, and I think that's the hurt is where the violence arises from. You know, like if I can't take care of my hurt, then I end up reacting to it using anger as a vehicle to actually hurt other people, including myself.
You know? So what it really is not so much about, well, it's not at all about, as many people would wish, to learn a way to eliminate your anger.
Right.
You know, but you just said it. You said, well, the anger, or sort of what I hear is like the anger is sort of it's like a gate.
Yes.
You know? If you can get in touch with this, with the sensation of anger, if you can familiarize yourself with it, it'll lead you to something else, which you just called the woundedness.
The woundedness, right. And that's, you know, what you just offered is exactly it. This isn't a book about getting rid of anger, about eliminating anger. I think that's why it's disappointing for some people. Because, you know, people want to get rid of the things that are uncomfortable.
Yes.
And this is the opposite. This book is really about, let's go deeper into the things that make us uncomfortable. Because if you go deeper into it, you'll actually start understanding how to be free from it. Getting free from something doesn't mean that it goes away. It means that I'm not bound to it any longer. I'm not in a reactionary relationship.
That's a very beautiful sentence when you say getting free from something doesn't mean that it goes away.
Right.
Which is the general conception, you know?
Exactly.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
You know, it's you know, because I'll say that like everything in our experience is important. Like it's valuable. Even if it's really uncomfortable, it's still really valuable. So in my practice, I am trying to learn from these things that I find uncomfortable. And I want there to be space for everything. You know, so I want to make space for everything to be in my experience, you know, including anger. You know, anger isn't the issue. You know, it's my relationship to the anger that's the issue. That's the thing. You know, it's, you know, we talk about, so in America, we talk about guns, you know, like, you know, and guns aren't the issue. Like it's our relationship to the guns. It's how we've created a meaning around a gun. That's the issue, you know? And that's what I want to emphasize over and over and over again. I want to transform my relationship to the things that have traditionally created violence and harm. You know, the issue is in the relationship, how I'm relating to something, how I'm trying to use that thing. You know, how I'm running away from something and my own experience and using that thing to feel better. You know, we can talk
using
about
it substance
to feel better. Yeah. You know, it's the same thing with substances. We talk about, you know, drug and alcohol addiction. That's a part of it. You know, it's like, how am I using this other thing to take care of myself, you know, or think that I'm taking care of myself with this thing? You know, and maybe, you know, which is, of course, what I believe, but like, I believe that I have to bring my attention back to why I'm trying to be in a certain relationship with this thing, you know? So we talk about anger. So the question that's at the heart of my practice is why am I in a certain relationship with anger? Why am I in a reactionary relationship with anger? Why do I get angry or feel pissed off and instantly react and do something? Like, that's the question that we should be bringing our practice to being curious about and working with.
This leads me to to think of something in your previous book, Radical Dharma.
Yeah.
A passage that there's also a lot in there, but one thing that also stuck with me is that you were talking about anger and you were talking about healing. Mm-hmm. And as you're talking about healing, you say that some people are suspicious of healing because there is a belief that if I somehow work with my anger, if I work with my being pissed off, you know, I'm going to lose something. I'm going to lose a connection to the suffering of others. Yeah. Or I'm going to lose a connection to this ground energy that I utilize in order to act. So if you look at your anger and if you transcend it, how are you not losing the connection? How are you not losing this energy? Like, you know, how is that fear not based on truth? You know?
Yeah. Well, there is a truth there. Absolutely. You're losing something. Anger is a really powerful, vital, dynamic energy that can propel us through a lot of things. You know, it is at the heart, I think, of how many of us experience courage. Like, being courageous means that, like, we're pushing through the things that scare us. You know, and we're using anger to do that. And I do that quite often, absolutely. You know, but the difference that I'm talking about is I am not using anger to do all the work for me. I am actually coming from a place of love. Mm-hmm. You know, because the issue is anger is depleting. Like, it depletes us. Love is restorative. Mm-hmm. You know, so I move through the world because I want people to be happy and I want people to be free from suffering. And I have the same wish for myself. That drives me. That's the root of my courage now. My anger is something that actually helps to support that intention, that motivation. You know, so when I'm like really, like practically, when I'm in a situation, yes. And I was in a situation last week in an online meeting where, like, there was something happened and I had to address it. You know, and I was really angry. I was pissed off. You know, and so my experience was actually giving a lot of space to the anger. And just paying attention to it. Like, I go through all of this in love and rage. Like, I pay attention to the anger. I notice the anger. And I say, okay, I'm pissed. I'm definitely pissed. And this is also an experience. I'm having an experience of being angry. You know? There was someone that I had to address who was the cause of tension in the situation. And it was my job to neutralize that situation. So when it came time for me to actually address this person, I actually had to move into recognizing love, that I just want people to be happy. I want people to be free from suffering. This is why I'm doing it. I'm not doing this because I'm pissed off. I'm doing this because I want people to be better, you know, to be more authentic, to suffer less. But the anger was there, and I was riding the anger. So the anger was reminding me, okay, this is what happened, you know, this is the situation, this is what you're working with. And as long as I kept an eye on the anger, I could continue. It was like riding a wave. It was like surfing. I was surfing on the anger, and that was energy that I was using to move me forward. But the love was the energy that I was using to really, like, be skillful, to be kind, but to be direct and truthful. And when you bring both of those practices together, this is what I'm talking about, you know, the coming together of love and rage.
So it's also, it's on the one side, it's a working with these emotions, it's familiarizing with them, because I imagine in order to ride a wave, you have to familiarize yourself, you know, with the waters and with how they move and so on, you know. So I guess you have to go into the water first, you know? So it's a process of familiarizing yourself with this, with the anger, with this rage, or with whatever that the fuel is. And at the same time, it's also, would you say it's like a proactive cultivation of love or of compassion as a base?
I would say so, yeah. Yeah. You know, absolutely. You know, it's, it's the love and compassion that holds the anger. You know, so it holds my hurts. You know, that has to be cultivated for self as well. So this is why this practice is so hard, because it's, I have to love myself enough to do this. You know, and that self-love is, I think, one of the hardest things we'll ever do in our practice. It's been one of the hardest things for me to work with.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I was just going to wholeheartedly agree.
And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. I think this should be the root of our practice, is self-love. And from the practice of self-love, which is a process. It's not like we just land somewhere and say, okay, this is it. I love myself. I think self-love is just a process. We have to commit ourselves to the process each day. You know, as much as possible, each moment I'm committing myself to self-love, right? You know, and that love actually gives me permission to actually take care of the anger, to tend to my anger. You know, I see it as valuable. When I love myself, I see my whole experience, my body and my mind, as valuable, as important. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that I'm pushing to the margins and believing that it's not valuable, that I shouldn't work with it. Everything is workable within the space of self-love.
If that sounds true and it sounds wonderful, mm-hmm. though, in my experience, there are a lot of obstacles mm-hmm. on the way to self-love, right? Yeah. There is guilt, shame, yeah. It's rage, it's all these things. Yeah. So are we again sort of talking about the same approach of sort of sitting with the guilt and sitting with the obstacles that are in the way of self-love in order to use those as a gate?
Yes. You know what? I have this teaching, which is we have to love even what is unlovable. And so what I mean by love is this non-judgmental acceptance of what is. Okay. So when I say acceptance, I don't mean condoning. I don't mean celebrating. I mean just recognizing something for what it is, be it shame, guilt, self-hate, whatever it may be. I can recognize it and say, there you are. And it's not a judgment. It's just a statement of reality. This is my experience that I'm having, you know. And once I recognize the experience, once I accept the experience, then I can actually begin to do the work of moving through it, you know, of holding space for it, really. Because the acceptance is really about holding space. You know, it's about allowing something to be there. That's really self-love. That's really it in a nutshell, right? You know? And it's not about being comfortable or feeling good.
Yeah.
You know, the practice of love and acceptance will open the door into experience. I begin to experience the material in my mind and my body. And when I experience something, then it begins to transform naturally, automatically. You know, because the situation that we're working with now is that, like, many of us we stand a distance away from our experience. Like, we're not experiencing, we're just standing over in the corner looking at the experience, making assumptions. Mm-hmm. You know, use anger, for example. Like, many people actually don't understand what anger is because they've never experienced the anger. They've only reacted to the anger. Mm-hmm. You know, so once we actually start moving closer to the anger, holding space for it, accepting it, then you start actually experiencing it. You begin to experience it as a physical reality. You begin to experience it as a mental reality, and then it will naturally transform. You know, I say that in my work, I say that you will gain agency over the experience, instead of the experience having agency over you. Because when I'm standing in the corner looking at my anger, making assumptions, my anger has agency over me. Mm-hmm. You know, But when I come closer, look into it, begin to experience, I actually begin to express agency over the anger. And that's the path of liberation. That's the path of liberation. It's the experience, experiencing it, letting it go. And I have a whole series of practices in love and rage that helps us to do that. You know, let's move closer. Let's experiment. Let's investigate, right? Let's experience. Let's let it go. You know, what does that mean to let anger go? You know, I have this process called SNOL, you know, and it's like a meditation practice. And the last parts of that practice is letting it go and letting it float. You know, so not only do I let the anger or whatever it is I'm experiencing, not only do I just kind of let it go, I let it just float in my experience. You know? And that's important. I can just look at it. I'm like, oh, look, there's the anger. There's my hurt. There's my joy too, because this also works with joy. Pleasant experiences. You know, anger isn't so special. It's like any other emotion that we experience, you know, but somehow we've labeled it less than the experience of joy, or less desirable than joy or happiness, you know, and so forth. But part of the tradition of meditation, you know, and many traditions of meditation, is really asking us to say, you know what, how can we begin to see all the material in our minds as equal? You know, how do we begin to do that?
So this is also, it seems also to relate a little bit to this idea of spiritual bypassing, you know, where or as an opposition to it. Whereas I experience, I also have to include myself at some point into this, where I experience people entering a spiritual path or a meditation practice, firstly with the desire or with the wish to be happy. Or to get better, you know, to overcome, get rid of whatever it is, right? So, and this idea of like leaning into the emotions and sort of also bringing happiness, giving it the same, or joy, right? Giving it the same importance or the same kind of holding it in the same way as you hold anger, it seems counterintuitive at first. It seems like, you know, why am I embarking on this spiritual journey? I don't want to feel worse.
And that's a basic misunderstanding of spirituality. Because I think when spirituality meets the marketplace, it's spirituality is rebranded as a feel-good kind of this feel good thing as a product. It's like, I can just like taking a pill. I'm going to take this pill. I'm going to take whatever it is. I'm going to feel good in 30 minutes. And that's how spirituality, particularly mindfulness meditation, is branded, you know, but actually the heart of a spiritual path is about transformation, inner and outer transformation. Transformation is really difficult. You know, and I know many people come to the practices wanting to feel happy, wanting to be more comfortable. And it's not that I have a problem with that necessarily. Like I think that it's okay for us to be clear about what we want. But I also say that my motivation in spirituality is to get free, you know, to experience both social and ultimate liberation. And of course, ultimate liberation is probably going to happen quicker than social liberation at this point. So my goal is to get free. I teach practices for people to get free. That means we have to go into the shit that scares us. That means that we may start a practice which is probably not going to feel so good. There are many stories. When I first started practicing, I was really fortunate because I had examples around me of people who were very clear about what practice was. They were very clear that, no, like you'll start this and it may not feel good for a while. You know, it doesn't feel good for a while because you're doing something you've never done before, which is actually moving into the things that are really uncomfortable. And I had to trust that. I had to trust that me feeling worse was actually going to end up with me feeling freer. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I say freer, I also mean to say spacious. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. My freedom arises out of spaciousness. I just want there to be space. That's really not just like I say the goal of my practice and teaching is to get free, but I'm also saying that like the goal of my practice and teaching is to remember the spaciousness mm-hmm. in my mind. When I have space, then I have options. Mm. You know, I'm not bound by the material in my mind. I'm not bound by my anger. I'm not even bound by the happiness and the joy. Like there's a mix. Everything's there. I don't feel constricted. I feel as if I can move. I have mobility.
So when you say space, and just to you know, explore into that, would you say you are talking about a broadened sense of experiencing, which sort of encompasses and holds your emotion or your reactivity or whatever it is happening within this broader context of space.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And nor does it mean that I space out. Like I think difference. Also, yeah, it's a big difference. I think that's what many people hear when they hear me say that. It's like, oh, the potential is that I'll just space out and get numb or distracted. And it's really not the case. The awareness deepens, right? You know, the awareness deepens. And so when the awareness deepens and the space deepens, your reactivity, like it's minimized, you know? So again, like when we have spaciousness, I don't find that like I'm habitually reacting to everything. Mm. But what I begin to discover is that I can actually make a choice as to how I'm responding to something. Mm. You know, and in my practice now, yeah, I can feel, you know, the past couple of months have felt really heavy and tough for not just for myself, but billions of people, you know. And if I didn't have a meditation practice, then I would be responding, reacting to the heaviness in ways that, you know, may not have been healthy, you know. Yeah. But I can, in a moment, I can say, like, I'm feeling really sad. I'm feeling really hopeless. Like, it just seems, the world just seems hopeless. And politics and the environment and, you know, racial justice, all this seems really overwhelming and helpless. I can notice it. You know, and I can say, okay, I just want this to be in my experience. I just want to hold it, you know? And again, going back, it's like, as I hold it, I begin to experience it, you know? And the more you learn to experience, the less afraid you become of the material in your mind. And I say, oh, there's sadness again, right? There's despair again. But there's also happiness. Look at that. There's happiness. There's gratitude as well. You know, because the space helps us to see everything, both the joy and the sorrow, you know. But I think that you have to be willing to do the work of experiencing really uncomfortable things and learning how to sit through that. And I just have a natural, I really do have a natural kind of, I don't know, tendency to do that. You know, I just come from, you know, I just come from an upbringing where I just had to work. It was just work, you know, so I'm used to working, you know. And so I think when I came into meditation, you know, even though it was a lot of work, right? It was like, it was a lot of work. It was a different kind of work. I'd never done the work of really mental health in the way that I was doing when I started meditating. And that was a different kind of work. And I had to learn how to do that kind of work, that really hard work. But I did learn how to do it.
I think, and you said at first you actually hated it.
I hated it.
Didn't like meditation at all, you know?
It was horrible. Like, it was so horrible. I couldn't understand how anyone could possibly do this. Mm. Again, I would sit down and all the suffering would come up. Like, as soon as I turned my attention to it, it was just unbearable. And I would I couldn't deal with it. But I quit and I came back to it because I realized finally, like, oh, this is supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I came back to meditation practice early in my practice, I realized that, you know, before, when I first started meditating, I was just doing it because everyone else was doing it, you know. But when I came back to practice for the second time, I was doing it because I wanted to be well. I knew that I had to do this for myself, and that motivation completely changed, you know, how I learned to work through everything that came up for me in the practice.
And that was also the realization that you get that realization quite early to say, okay, this is not about happiness after sitting for 20 minutes. This is about freedom after going through the hurt, the pain, the woundedness.
You know? Yeah. And it's not even about peace in the way that we think about peace. You know, I wasn't thinking about peace. I wasn't thinking about happiness. I was just thinking about, I have to explore this part of myself.
Yes.
You know, there's something here that I have to get to. I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I would get the teachings and I would study space, you know, this idea of spaciousness and everything. I just felt like that was so far away from me. But in the moment, I was dealing with these really basic things, with the basic suffering that I was experiencing. And then over time, you know, what I can definitely say is that the space begins to open up when we commit ourselves, you know, and I really committed to the practice. I committed to a daily meditation practice. I committed eventually to going to retreats and studying with teachers. And of course, I've always been reading. So reading the books, and you have to consume the teachings. You have to consume whatever you can get your hands on, because that's all going to be a foundation for the practice. You know, and you just do it. You keep coming back. As we use this expression, coming back to the cushion. But, you know, that's just a way for us to say we just keep coming back to the practice over and over again. And the practice, again, is basically just looking, noticing, becoming aware of, you know, accepting, holding space for it. That's the only thing I do. That's literally the only thing that I do in my practice. Yeah, I may have I do all kinds of practices. You know, I'm a tantra practitioner, so I do all kinds of rituals and deity practice and chanting. But really, at the end of the day, this is all I'm doing. You know, these practices support the work of holding everything in my experience, and that makes me more human. Mm. You know, I feel much more human now than I have ever felt, you know, because I can feel the joy and the sorrow, and I'm not running away from either. Of course, you know, I don't, you know, many of us don't run away from joy, you know, but we definitely run away from the sorrow.
Oh, there are some that run away from joy. Yeah.
Well,
it also happens. You just mentioned you're a tantric practitioner. Just a short side detour. You do have a very, let's call it, traditional training. You know, you went through the 3-year retreat, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you sort of did that very quickly, right? I mean, you did it in the 3 years and 3 months or whatever, but you sort of, from beginning to practice meditation to going into the rigorous retreat. Yeah. How quickly did it go?
It was very quick. It was so quick that it startled everyone. not just my friends, you know, and family who were just startled by the fact that I was going into a retreat, which felt like a cult.
Did you do it in one sitting?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Literally. Yeah. Okay.
Literally one sitting. Yeah. And, but, you know, I was surrounded by long-term practitioners. People who had been practicing for decades, far longer than I had been practicing. And then as soon as I really got serious about practice, I made a commitment to do this.
Yeah.
And then my practitioner friends were like, how?
Yeah.
You know, you're just like the analogy is I was just learning how to drive. And I just got my driver's license and I made a declaration to become a race car driver. You know, and I did, you know, I knew exactly what I needed to do. That was very clear. And I think we do, like many people have had these experiences in their lives where they absolutely know what needs to be done, you know, and that opened up for me really clearly. And I had to, it was a lot of resistance around me, you know, but when people realized I was really serious, that I was actually going to do it, then people really started getting behind me and supporting me, you know? So I, you know, so the timeline really, I'd only been practicing maybe 2 years, maybe before I moved to a monastery, but that's quick though. That's still super quick,
sure.
You know, particularly the 3-year retreat is like the dream for so many people. It is such a privilege to get to do that. You know, to be able to leave your life for 3 years, you know, and have everything taken care of in your life and to step into this situation.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of work, but I was also really lucky because I was in my 20s. I didn't have anything. Like I didn't own a house. I wasn't in a relationship. I wasn't tied to the world.
Yeah.
You know, so I do have colleagues, friends who were deeply tied to the world. They had kids and families and partners and houses. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that took a significant amount of effort for them, you know, to leave that life and to come into it. So, but you do what you have to do. Mm-hmm. If this is something you're called to do. And this is the part about the spiritual path that like I always want to communicate to folks, is that if you really want to get free, if you really make an authentic aspiration to get free, you have to be willing to really meet what arises. You have to meet the invitations that you receive to further that freedom work. And it means it's different for everyone. For me, it meant 3 years of retreat. For others, it means that like you change your career or you leave a relationship or whatever it may be. You become a monastic, a monk or a nun or something. You know, it's different for everyone, you know, but there is a level of courage that we have to embody to do things that can get us free. Because at the end of the day, I tell people it's like, I have to do these things for myself, even though it's really hard. Like it was really hard for people, for me to leave for years, to leave people's lives, you know?
Sure.
It was tough, right? You know, but I had to put myself first because I knew that I wouldn't be able, like, let's just say I wouldn't be having this conversation with you right now if I hadn't done that.
Yes.
Like I wouldn't be here. You know?
I think it's an interesting perspective to look at because especially where you in your teachings, in your practices, you emphasize, I think it's also one of the five, you know, basic principles that you employ in teaching, you know, is that there is always the awareness of connectedness to the community or connectedness to the collective, you know, like how you practice and what you do and how you are as a being has an impact on your surrounding.
Absolutely.
So there's a conception sometimes, you know, especially if you're in very activist circles and so on, you know, there's a conception that mm-hmm. if you do a 3-year retreat, mm-hmm. which is, call it an extreme, right? But mm-hmm. if you go on shorter retreats, if you take time for your practice and so on, there's a suspicion
yeah.
that might be a selfish
yeah.
thing to do. It's like, oh, yeah. this is a selfish act. This is
yeah.
time away from, you know,
yeah.
Being there for the collective.
Yeah.
At the same time,
yeah.
if you just exert yourself in a certain way without replenishing, without looking at yourself, you might go into burnout. You might go yes. into a trap of sort of
yes.
being reactionary with your emotions and so on. And so how would you describe this sort of this balance of, yeah. of your spiritual practice then going back into the collective and vice versa?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, those were the conversations that people were having with me when I decided to do this. Those are the exact conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
That people were suspicious that I was being criticized for giving up and doing something really selfish. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from that experience. I just learned that, like, we don't value self-care and self-preservation and movement work. You know, like, we don't, yes. like, we, like, it's almost as if, well, back then, you know,
yeah.
back when I was on the streets, you know, doing work really actively, the thing was that I just felt like the more burnt out you were, the angrier you were, that was celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're tired and overwhelmed and people would look at you and say, oh, like they're really committed to the work.
It's quite a capitalist kind of approach, right?
It's like work.
It's like the managers or whoever, the workers that are really overworked. That's like, they're going for it, you know?
Yeah, they're overwhelmed, overworked, tired, fatigue, you know?
Yeah.
And people would have breakdowns, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, that was really bad. Like when someone had a breakdown, but when people were really tired, it was like, oh yeah, they're really doing the work. And I just, you know, when I decided to go away, I said, you know, I'm going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to come back, but I won't survive the world if I don't do this work for myself now.
Mm-hmm.
Nor will I have anything really valuable to contribute to the movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I don't do this inner work, someone has to do the inner work. You know, we have to. Another thing that I take really seriously is eldership. Like, I want to become an elder,
mm-hmm.
but you have to do the work to enter into eldership, you know? And I know that we're missing, it's not that we're missing elders, the elders are around, you know, but I want to do my work so I can claim my place as an elder, you know? So people can look at me and say, oh, you have something interesting and valuable to offer,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the younger generations. But you know, I had to push against a lot of folks going into a retreat, you know, and it's only because of that work, which has led me to do 2 books that are for activists, you know, that speak directly to activists. You know, I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have written these books without that experience, you know, because I want us to be sustainable,
mm.
you know, and I want us to, I think our activism has to transform, you know, and I think there has to be a level of care and collective care and individual care, you know, within collective movements, you know, there has to be healing. Like, yeah, we have to disrupt systems of violence, but we also have to heal at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do both at the same time. But it takes an expertise, and it takes those of us coming back into the community to show folks how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the collective is really important for me. I do everything for the collective. You know, everything is about trying to help people feel freer, feel less, just experience less suffering, to be more connected, to have more happiness, whatever it may be. You know, it's not just for me, you know, which is, this is the philosophy of what we call the bodhisattva, you know, in Buddhism, which is like the saint. This is this, you know, we call it spiritual warrior, but it's like really about being a saint. You know, this is a spiritual saint. And the heart of the bodhisattva commitment is that we keep coming back to help people, that this isn't about ourselves. Yeah, we take care of ourselves, we do work for ourselves, but that work is only being done so we can offer back to the folks around us, to our communities, to our collectives, to our affinity groups, whomever it may be. You know, it's not self-indulgent. You know, and I think my retreat seemed self-indulgent to folks, and I get it. Like it did seem self-indulgent. It seemed like Buddha's summer camp to folks. It seemed like, oh, you're going to take a 3-year vacation, right? Because everything is taken care of, right? Like you have people cooking for you and doing all the stuff for you, so you can just practice.
Yeah, you know, you're working
3 years practicing. You're working through, and that's the piece that people don't connect to, right? Yeah. Like you're like my, you know, your ass is getting kicked perpetually because there are these conditions that have been created where you can't actually avoid it anymore. You can't bypass it. And this is why 3-year retreat is such an intense experience, because, you know, you're not bypassing it anymore. You know, so the shit that scares the shit out of you, like, you're going to have to deal with, you know, whatever you've considered a nightmare, you're going to actually have to live through over and over and over again until you learn how to be liberated from it. You know, this is why this experience isn't for everyone. Like, this 3-year retreat is not something I prescribe to anyone. I've never told anyone that they should do that. I knew I needed to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people come to me who want to do it actually don't want to do it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Like, you literally have to be called to do this. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't consult anyone. Like, I knew, like, I absolutely knew that this was exactly what I was going to do. So I didn't ask anyone's permission. Of course, I asked my teacher's permission in the monastery. You had to go through the application process, absolutely. But I didn't have to, like, ask anyone permission to ask to go into retreat, you know?
Yes.
Like, I knew that this is exactly what I wanted to do. And you have to have that confidence. You need that confidence to make it through what can be the hardest experiences of your life. It was the hardest experience I'll ever have.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even think death is going to be that hard compared, you know, to what I went through. But that experience prepared.
Plus you're already a little prepared. You did the Kaju retreat, right? So you did the six yogas. You're a little prepared for death.
You know, it takes the fear away from death because you have to learn how to live your life. And that's the thing. That's what prepares us for death. We live our lives. We don't wait till tomorrow
or the next day or next week. That's a beautiful sentence.
Yeah. But you can't live your life if you're afraid of the material in your experience. You know, if you keep running away from everything. Yeah, that's it. It's a circle. We go back to the beginning. If you can't be with your anger, then you're not living your life.
Mm.
You know, living your life means that, like, you're experiencing everything, you're holding space for everything, you know, and that's going to facilitate a very different life. Like,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Mm-hmm. There is something that, you know, if this is something that, you know, you don't want to talk about, you can just say it and we'll cut it out later or something. But as you say, experiencing everything and living your life fully, it sometimes in my experience it can mean wrestling with or holding seeming opposing opposites, right? And that's a very interesting experience. So I would like to ask you about something I heard in an interview that you did with Ethan Nickturn, and you were speaking about how there was instances of abuse happening in your Sangha, also connected to your teacher, and that there was that for you it was a I don't want to put these words in your mouth, but I'm wondering, and I think this is something that in other ways a lot of us experience. You have this maybe intense love for a person or this connection, and you have this gratitude, or you have this one feeling, and then at the other side there is another thing that comes in. There's a hurt, there's a disappointment, mm-hmm. there is something that goes against one's mm-hmm. convictions or values. Mm-hmm. Usually we are pressured to choose. Mm-hmm. It's like, what side are you on, right? Like, how are you going to react to this? How are you going to clear cut and so on and so on? But it seems like let me not put these words in your mouth, but there might also be another proposition. There might be a proposition of, can you be with all of it? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. could you say something about that? Could you maybe even, would you be willing to share your experience of that, of holding those things together, if it was like that at all?
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, and it actually goes to the title of the book, Love and Rage, you know, because everyone asks, well, aren't these completely opposite, you know, things? And I say, no, actually, like, they're complementary, you know? And so, and that kind of love and rage also came out of my experience with my teacher. So my teacher for years had been engaged in, you know, unethical sexual relationships, you know, with female students, you know, and one of them being a really good friend of mine. And so when I found out about it, I was completely disappointed, and hurt, you know, and I was with those experiences, hurt, disappointment, you know, and I had to spend a little bit of time working through it, you know. And then, of course, after about a year or two of me working with it, all this became public, you know, so it became this really public thing. And I just got really involved with so much of the public rhetoric around it and public, you know, stuff. And that really began the rage part for me. That really began, you know, I was just really pissed off at it. I was pissed off at my teacher. I was pissed off at my community. I was pissed off at the people who were trying to excuse the behavior, you know. And I was experiencing all this anger, but at the same time, I still love my teacher, you know. And it took me an even longer period to really hold the space for all of that. And really what it meant that, like, I had to rest within love, and I had to just continually over and over and over again experience the anger, the rage that kept coming up, you know, which was also the heartbreak, the complete utter disappointment, and the shame and the guilt, everything that comes from that. So all of that was happening at the same time, you know, and you just, again, it's the space. Everything was just happening within the space. I learned enough. You know, this has been just over the past 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years that this really came out. Like, it was learning how to just to sit and experience all of this really intense energy, you know.
How do we enable, you just said it's a couple of years.
Yeah.
We live in a time in which we are asked to react and have a position instantly.
Yeah. And I had a position.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a position, and it was, my position was, it wasn't that I hated my teacher, you know, and, well, let me just reframe that. You know, my position was coming into the middle. You know, so I couldn't completely write off my teacher, because there were people who were like, people were like, let's forget it. This is all really messed up. You know, he's not authentic. Let's forget. Let's walk away. That was one extreme. Then the other extreme was like, you can't possibly give up on your teacher. Like, yes. Whatever he did, it was just a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
That was another extreme. And none of those extremes felt authentic for me. So my position was the complexity of being in the middle. It was like, I love my teacher. I recognize that I probably wouldn't have the life that I have without him being in my life. But he also did something that was really messed up and wrong and hurtful and violent. You know, and both of those were my position. And that really pissed people off.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. That really, and that made me an outsider for a while. You know, it's a hard place to be, because for me, it is an expression of maturity when I can see all of this and hold all these complex positions. And for me, that is the point, one of the points in my practice too, is like, I want to hold complexity. Like, I want to hold nuance. I want to hold subtlety. And I felt like everyone was bypassing the complexity because it hurt too much and it was too much work. It's so easy to be extremist. You know, it's so easy to be super radical, or it's so easy to be super conservative. Like, you know, I'm going to hit these extremes, but to come into the middle and to say, you know what, I see a lot of truth around me. You know, and this is where I'm choosing to be right now, you know, because that is what's going to heal me. That's what's going to keep my heart open. That's the point of this. I need to keep my heart open.
Yes.
And if I hit an extreme, my heart shuts down to another position.
Yeah.
You know, the middle is the hardest place for us to be, because we have to, we're forced. When we come into the middle, we're forced to stay in relationship to all the things that are really uncomfortable. You know, and the things that feel really good aren't distracting any longer. You know, because we get into these things that feel good, and it takes us out of the suffering. It's like, I just want to feel good. Like, I just want to get into this view, this philosophy, this belief. But when you're in the middle, like, it doesn't take you. It just keeps you within this mix of all these complexities, you know? And there's not a timeline here. Like, the middle isn't an instant liberation. Yeah. It is liberation over a period of time that can sometimes feel excruciating, you know? Particularly when you're surrounded by people who are forcing you.
Yes.
To hit an extreme.
But the middle doesn't have to mean that it doesn't have to mean passivity.
Right? Exactly. I think the middle is extremely active. Like, I think you have to work to be in the middle. I think the middle is the most active place that we can be within a position. You know, like another example right now for me being in America is, you know, I look at, you know, we have this Make America Great Again crowd, you know, which on one hand, if I were, you know, hitting an extreme, I would say, well, they're a fucking pain in the ass is what they are. They're racist. They're, you know, they're all these things, right? That's one extreme, you know, and that's, you know, yeah, that feels natural. I want to be on that extreme, you know, but what's lost is my capacity to empathize with this other group, you know, with the Make America Great. You know, there's woundedness and hurt there that I want to do a little bit of work of connecting to, because I don't want them, even using them can be objectifying, but like, I don't want people to be objectified in my experience in the same way that I've often felt objectified. Like, I don't want to put that out in the world. Like, I have to disrupt that.
Same hurt, sort of.
Yeah, same hurt. Yeah. I want to see people as people. I want to see people as humans who are trying to make the best decisions, you know, given their condition, given how they were born, given, you know, the limited information that they have in the world, you know? Yes, and that's the middle. It's like, I don't agree with you. Sometimes I can't stand you, but I need to continue to relate to you as human, as someone who's exactly like me, you know, who experiences suffering, but also wants to be happy, wants to be free, you know? And then we have certain conditioning, certain identity locations, you know, that inform how we choose to get free. You know, and you know, one thing that I, you know, say all the time is that, like, I just don't know how people were born. I honestly don't. I don't just look at people and say and know, oh, like, you were born into a really shitty situation and you actually didn't have a lot of support growing up. You didn't get a lot of love, right? Yeah. You know, and you actually don't understand love. You don't know how to receive love. You don't know how to express love. And maybe you're being a complete jerk to me in this moment, and maybe you're only doing that because that's the best way you know how to show up, because you hurt so much. You know, it's, on one hand we can say that's giving people the benefit of the doubt, but I would challenge that a little bit and say I just think there's a lot of truth in it, period. I just think that, like, we're informed by these things in our lives, and each moment that we show up is just an expression of what we've survived.
Yes.
To get to that moment, you know? And, like, it's not always about me. It's, you know, it's I would say often it's about our woundedness, our hurts, you know? And we're going to blame someone.
You know? That's an interesting thing, though, because the more you get in touch with your own woundedness, which is, you know, again, behind the rage or behind the disappointment or behind all that stuff, right? I have a feeling that there is a strong sense of connection to other people, because we are all very much the same in the way we are. Our personality is made, you know, from our experiences and so on, and our reactions, our emotional constructions, how they function, is a lot of it is protection from feeling the wound, right? So if we can connect on that deep level of where all of us have that shared humanity of mm-hmm. woundedness, of experience of pain and so on, you know, that's mm-hmm. I think that's incredibly beautiful and valuable. And there is something I would like to ask you about, which is also, I think, which is related but very difficult to connect with, and I'd like to, I'm reading this, I'm paraphrasing. We believe healing is reserved for the oppressed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we are upset to believe that mm-hmm. the oppressor is mm-hmm. in just as much need of healing. Mm-hmm. And if the oppressor is healed, he or she might not produce so much violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a very controversial statement.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah. I would go on a limb and say mm-hmm. I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah.
You know, if my opinion matters for anything, but yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah.
Yet I think that is a very difficult way to, that is a very difficult thing to relate with.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's a really hard thing for us to be with, because I think a legitimate criticism of that statement is that, well, if you say that, then you're taking attention away from oppressed people, you know, and centering the pain of the oppressor. And I think that's legitimate in a way, you know, but when I and I was really coming into that teaching and that's, you know, and writing that, I was just realizing, oh, like, we're all hurting, you know? And I think, and I would think about the ways in which I had been hurt by other people. And I would say, yes. God, I wonder if that person were actually happy, would I have been hurt in the way that I was hurt? You know, or to make it even more personal, right? Like, in situations where I have been the aggressor, like, if I were actually really happy, would I have committed the violence that I committed?
Yes.
You know, whatever that violence was. And so I really like that led me to really just having to open to this reality that, yeah, like we all actually need to be healed. You know, like white people have to be healed from white supremacy, you know?
Yeah.
Men, cisgender men have to be healed from patriarchy.
Yes.
As well as those who are victims of patriarchy, like women and gender non-conforming folks and trans folks. Like, it's not just the oppressed, it's the oppressed. Like, let's just bring it back to patriarchy. For me, it's like,
sure.
I have had to do this work, and I continue to do this work, to understand how patriarchy has taken away my capacity to do emotional labor for myself, you know? Mm. And I've had to restore that capacity through practice. You know, of course, and that was the main criticism people were coming to me early in my practice around. They were like, you seem detached, you seem apathetic. And I had to use my meditation practice to do everything that we've been talking about. I had to actually move closer into all these emotions, including anger that I was always running away from. You know, and that began the work of understanding what emotional labor was for myself. And that emotional labor actually began to disrupt these messages, this conditioning from patriarchy, you know, that says that I have to be distant from my emotions.
Yeah.
You know, and doing emotional labor for myself, touching into my emotional reality has limited greatly the kinds of violence that I commit and engage in. I can listen more, I can feel more, you know, I'm more sensitive. Like I cry, like crying is a practice of mine.
Oh yeah.
You know, like feeling the heartbreak, the despair, and like sitting with the shame and the guilt. So I think a lot of patriarchal, I'll take that back. I think all of the violence of patriarchy is around our inability to be with shame and guilt. You know, and how we react to the shame and guilt and the anger around that shame and guilt, and we harm other people, you know, including ourselves, but mostly other people, you know, particularly other people and groups who remind us that there's a different way to be in the world than just shut down and isolated and numb. And that's scary. I think that's scary. You know, I think you get to our age and you begin to look at people in our age group and you see people who have never actually figured out who and what they are. You know, they've never asked these questions. They've never had these conversations before. Yeah. And then they start thinking about it. And I think on one hand, that's amazing. That's incredible. But on the other hand, it's like, oh my God, you're just doing this now. You know, but it's never too late. I feel like it's never too late, but I'm just so grateful that I've been able to do this work for almost 20 years of my life. You know, which is almost half of my life now. But yeah, so that's, again, that's the healing.
Yeah.
You know, that's the healing we engage in. And that frees people around us.
Mm-hmm. That frees people around us is sort of, would you say that by going through this yourself, you're also giving the permission to other people or empowering other people around you?
Absolutely. If people know and trust us and they see us doing certain things, then they will trust the process more, you know, like when I see people doing things, that's how I get really involved in things. I say, oh, that person's doing this thing. This person I really admire and respect and know really well, if they're doing it, you know, it must be like really interesting and good, you know. But another part of that, even if people don't know you, they will begin to sense the ways in which you like there's a way in which we put up an armor, a barrier, you know, and I think that when we do this work, that barrier, that armor is taken down. I think people will feel that. And when they feel that, they will feel safer around you because you're not armed up, ready to attack anyone. Right. You know, and so I can walk through the world. I can still have boundaries. This isn't like boundaries are necessary and important, you know, but I have learned that like there are certain boundaries that are really necessary, but they don't have to be boundaries that block the whole world from seeing me. You know, of course, like there are different people who have different access to me, you know, but for the most part, publicly, you know, I kind of move through the world with a lot of vulnerability, a lot of openness. And that's, I've learned how to be safe doing that. Safe maybe is not the word. I would say I've learned how to take care of myself, being that vulnerable, you know, in the world. And I know that this level of vulnerability helps other people to be free. It gives permission, as you were saying, it gives permission for other people to do the work. If they see me doing it, they're like, okay, here's an example of someone who's actually making this work in the world. But again, it's a whole circle. It comes back to how willing I am to be with the discomfort. You know, how am I taking care of the discomfort and so forth? Like, that's the issue. That's the point. If I'm not taking care of the discomfort, I won't be vulnerable in the world. You know, I wouldn't be able to do this. And I write in a way that's really vulnerable and really open. And you know, people read my work and they think they know me. In a way, they do. You know, that's, you know, I'm in this position where so many people know much more about me than I know about them. And so that creates a kind of familiarity when I meet people. Like, they know all this stuff about me. And I'm okay. I did that on purpose. That wasn't an accident.
Sure.
You know, but like there are still things that are still reserved.
Of course.
For people who are closest to me, you know, even though I have a deep capacity to share a lot of things, I can only share it because I have a practice to hold that sharing. Like, I don't hurt myself to share. Mm-hmm. I think there are people, public people, who continually hurt themselves, harm themselves by continually oversharing, you know, and that's one thing about social media is like, it's this place for people, you know, to get needs met. And one of the needs is to be seen, and you get seen by being vulnerable, but I don't think it's healthy for, I would say, a lot of people, especially if they don't have a practice to hold that sharing,
which again comes back to taking care of yourself and looking at why are you doing this and you know, what is the unmet need, maybe, you know.
Exactly. You know, it's about emotional labor too. It's like when I share, like I've already done the labor for myself. So when I share something, it's like I'm sharing something in a container. You know, and that's important for me. That's always important for me to do. It's like if I don't have a container for the vulnerability, then I'm actually forcing you to do emotional labor for me. You know, particularly, you know, that can be difficult, particularly if you haven't consented to that. Like if I haven't asked you to do that, then it's kind of like, you know, just dropping this labor on you. You know, I think that's part of how patriarchy perpetuates itself. It's like men have forced a lot of other people to do our emotional labor for us because we can't do it for ourselves. We don't have the capacity to do it for ourselves. You know, again, at the end of the day, my practice is only about holding space for everything. You're just noticing, being aware.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That was very touching. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your sharing your space. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wenn dich die Themen aus diesem Podcast interessieren, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in mein Buch reinzulesen. Es heißt, stell dir vor, du wachst auf. Die 4O+X-Methode für mehr Präsenz und Klarheit im Leben und ist erhältlich als broschiertes Buch, als E-Book und als Hörbuch. Wenn du dich über die Themen in diesem Podcast weiter austauschen möchtest, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in unsere Facebook-Gruppe zu kommen. Du findest sie bei Facebook unter Stell dir vor, du wachst auf, genau wie der Titel meines Buchs, oder auch unter 4O+X, also viermal der Buchstabe O, dann plus X, das ist der Name der Methode, die ich in dem Buch vorstelle. Wenn du mir Feedback geben möchtest, erreichst du mich bei Facebook/CursedOfficial, bei Instagram @CursedZeit oder über die E-Mail-Adresse coaching@cursed.de. Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal.